Good morning, and welcome to this Wednesday, April 15th, 2015 edition of Writers on Writing. We're on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, Orange County's source of talk, alternative music, and anteater sports. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at KUCI.org, available via podcast on iTunes and Stitcher, as well as on the blog on Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. Each week, Barbara, Marie, or I talk to authors, poets, or literary agents to give you insight and up-to-date information on the art and business of writing and publishing. I'll be talking to two guests this hour. This hour will be a de facto Iowa Writers Workshop MFA first novel show. During the second half of the hour, I will be on with debut novelist Angela Flournoy. But first up, debut novelist Jacob Rubin. Jacob's writing has appeared in the anthology Best New American Voices, The New Yorker Online, New York Magazine, Slate, The New Republic, N+1, and The Cincinnati Review. Times Square, a screenplay he co-wrote, was recently acquired by Focus Features. He lives in New York. His first novel, The Poser, was published by Viking in March, and I'm pleased to welcome him to the show. Hi there, Jacob.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Oh, we're glad you could join us. Let's start by having you tell us about your book. Can you introduce it to listeners?
Sure. So The Poser is about a character named Giovanni Bernini, who's born with the compulsion and the ability to imitate anyone he meets. And it's set in a sort of shadowy, bizarro America of sort of the 50s. And 60s, though it's never quite identified. And he, through the course of the novel, sort of undergoes various experiences and becomes famous in different ways, but all sort of while seeking to really become himself and not the various poses he puts on at different times.
Mm. Now, let's start with talking about the main character. So I was wondering, logistically, to characterize an impersonator, you have to be extra good at distilling people to their characteristics and basic gestures. And So I'm wondering if that was a strength of your writing to begin with, that you were always aware of, or was that something that you had to, you know, work on a little with this character you created?
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I sort of put myself in a corner a little bit because only I was so naive when I first began writing the book that only as I was sort of deep into it did I realize what a task I set for myself and how difficult it would be to sort of pull it off. But then I think I also realized that part of the reason I was maybe drawn to this character in the first place was because I do tend to observe people in certain ways and read things into their gestures and their presentations of self and things like that. So I think I had sort of landed on this topic without fully realizing the resonances that might be there in terms of how I see the world and how this character does. But I also think it was one of those things where the barrier between sort of just stupidity and courage can sometimes be blurred, and I was just maybe naive enough to try something like this, which maybe I would, you know, think twice of now or something.
I'm trying to write that down, the barrier between stupidity and courage. I like that.
Yeah, it's hard to tell the difference sometimes, yeah.
you also said that you were drawn to this character in the first place for the reasons you mentioned. So did this novel start with the character, or what was your point of entry into the novel?
Yeah, it definitely began with the character. I was actually years ago working on a short story about a guy who's had a one-night stand, and he finds himself in this woman's apartment remembering very little of the night before, and he's sort of rummaging through her trash to find clues about who she might be. And, you know, as he's fumbling through the trash, I'm sort of fumbling through the story, figuring out, like, what the hell I'm trying to write. And then he, in the trash, happens upon this photo of this very famous impressionist, this impersonator who could sort of be anyone that he meets. And I realized then that that character is really what I was interested in, and I think sort of shrewdly scrapped what was fastly becoming a very mediocre short story and went with that character. So it did definitely start with that character, and then only as I sort of followed him around to see who he was and what kind of predilections he had and all that, did I encounter the other people who eventually made up the novel.
Would you, speaking of your novel, The Poser, would you read to us from it?
Sure, absolutely. So this is early in the book, and this is just describing a scene, a classroom scene, and at a young age, the character Giovanni basically has trouble controlling his impulses to imitate people. So this is him describing his teacher and then him in class. Mr. Heedling. Whatever interest had led him to the profession of teacher, a desire on his part to spend his weeks in the company of 13-year-old boys and girls could not have been counted among them. The paraded sense of humor, the jaunty manner some teachers perfect so as to endear themselves to adolescent tastes, Heedling never attempted. He spoke to us like a drunk at a bar, often gruff, rarely dishonest. Word was he had been discharged from the army after falling victim to or helping perpetrate a massacre on a distant palm tree island. His method of instruction was one of impassioned repetition. The previous week he had repeated, "Don't you envy Sisyphus?" We were forced to scribble it in our notebooks 30 times. What did Helen of Troy look like, he asked that day. As he lectured, he stalked and circled our desk chairs, curling Mary Hammerworth's Anthology of Greek Myth around its spine. Since he could fly into a rage if he suspected the slightest bit of daydreaming or note-passing, the class did its best to strike postures of earnest attention. For my classmates, I guess this involved some theater, not for me. I loved the Greeks. They weren't like other stories where you, the reader, decide if they're any good. Questioning Atlas's or Icarus's fate was like complaining the ocean rolled the wrong way, or the sky carried the weather with too much pomp. Inspired by those stories, I'd been on good behavior all semester. Each fall was that way, offering a brief window of renewal. In recess, I watched the older boys play stickball. The way they strode and wound up to fling the ball, all of it such glamorous evidence of what growing up could do. And every night I went to bed hoping the big change would happen, that I would stretch to 6 feet tall and say goodbye to all that trouble at school. Tell me now, Helen of Troy, what did she look like? Heedling asked. My mother, Philip Howes volunteered. Philip sat in the front row and was always offering a first response to Heedling's questions, even though our teacher had never approved of his answers, and once in a fit of anger called him a quote-unquote true egg sucker. You're wrong, Heedling said. He asked Alice Crutt, who sat behind Philip. What did Helen of Troy look like? Rebecca Rell, the cheerleader. Absolutely incorrect. He asked Adrian Chidwood, who sat behind Alice. What did she look like? A movie star. Oh, God, he addressed the classroom. What did she look like? Silence. Jesus Christ, he said. Okay, stop there.
Thank you. That was author Jacob Rubin reading from his new book, The Poser. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine. And as I was driving here, I was trying to remember the point of view that you use. And so it's a sort of gentle first person. And so did you have any meandering to get to that point of view, or was that how it always began?
It sort of began as a first person. And I think in my experience, often that's, when you're getting an MFA, there's a lot, you talk a lot, obviously, about point of view and perspective. I think a lot of that stuff comes in handy once you've selected your point of view. So you learn some tips and tricks and craft stuff to help you execute, say, a third person, a close third person, or a first person, or even a second person. But in my experience, the sort of choice of which perspective to use is often unthinking and almost instinctual, and then all that, quote unquote training or whatever really comes in once you've made that almost unconscious selection. So I think I knew one way or another from the beginning, this is probably going to be a first-person narrative.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned earlier how this started off as a short story. Did you write a bunch of short stories before embarking on this novel?
It was really one, and then I... So once I sort of plucked this character from that other short story, I then wrote a short story about him. Though it didn't quite work as a short story, and I, you know, years later, as I was finishing the book, realized it was sort of a rough outline, really, or treatment, kind of, for what the novel would become. And a lot would change, but the general, almost emotional shape and trajectory of it was outlined in that story.
Hmm. And I think it's fair to say that in a lot of first novels, to varying degrees, there's some autobiographical content, but this one doesn't have that feel. I'm curious, first of all, if you're aware of that phenomenon or if you even agree. And also, I'm curious why you didn't. I mean, this novel's so original. I'm just curious how.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I definitely know that I definitely recognize the phenomenon you're describing, and I think it's true. I think maybe it comes out of some sort of insecurity I have about the value of my own experience or something, or whether it's remarkable or worth writing about. Though I think. You know, I sort of sufficiently taxed my imagination with this novel. I think maybe I'll, in future ventures, tax my courage more and sort of divulging more about my life, maybe. But I do think it's maybe uncharacteristic in that way for a first novel, because it's certainly not, about a tall Jewish person who lives in New York in the 2000s who, likes to watch basketball, which is what a book about me would be. So that's it'd be riveting, I'm sure.
Well, regarding the playful surrealism in your book, who are some authors that you admire?
In that vein, in terms of the playfully surreal, one of my contemporary favorites is Jonathan Lethem. I really his book Chronic City, I think is amazing. I mean, I love many of his novels, but that one I feel like maybe is underrated and neglected. And it sort of portrays this whole alternate New York with these magical elements that feel very resonant and meaningful. There's like a tiger that roams through the city, and there's this strange fog that's descended over Lower Manhattan. So he's definitely one I would strongly recommend. And there are a lot of short story writers. I mean, George Saunders, who's rightly celebrated, incorporates a lot of sort of sci-fi into short stories that are definitely literary fiction too. So he's one.
And we're talking to Jacob Rubin. His book is The Poser. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And this setting that you paint, this sort of 50s, although not pinned down, city environment, it has a cinematic feel to it. So I thought it was particularly interesting that you had written a screenplay as well. Does film influence you as well?
I think it has, yeah. I got into screenwriting after fiction writing, which is something that I've been doing longer. But I think, as a kid growing up in New York, I went to the movies all the time, and I come from a movie-going family. So I think, which is true of many people in my generation, that as much as I love reading and have always read, I think I am as influenced by visual storytelling, inevitably, just because I've been surrounded by it and took it in. So I do think consciously or not, I'm sure as I'm writing, I'm sort of trying to conjure scenes and images and descriptions that could be visualized or experienced the way a movie would.
I love hearing about the evolution of novels from genesis to execution. And so that was interesting about it starting as a short story. And when you were revising it, were there any other surprises that came out for you in terms of the way the plot went or the ending or anything?
Definitely. Yeah. I'm a believer in the maxim that that I was told, at least when I was getting my MFA, a lot of, no surprise for the writer, no surprise for the reader. So I definitely encountered many surprises in terms of how characters interacted, how relationships begin, and in some cases in the novel end. I'm going to try to tease. This is my sort of foreshadowing that exciting things happen in the book here without I was definitely, in a weird way, my experience with writing is often very almost passive. You're almost just sort of recording and following and then waiting to see what will happen rather than sort of consciously and very schematically outlining how characters will act and stuff like that. So I was definitely surprised frequently in the process.
And to get to that point, are there rituals that you follow, or do you write for a certain amount of time a day, or how do you optimize your life so that that happens maximally?
Yeah, I'm a big ritual person. So I find repetition and rituals very, very comforting, both in and outside of my writing life. So I could talk about this forever. This is where neurosis and discipline really dovetail. So I was really for a while into writing early in the morning. I found any hours when the world feels less populated and crowded and busy with other people's agendas are most fertile for creative work. So usually that means like early morning or the evening. Or another way to say that, I guess, is basically anything but the afternoon. I find the afternoon to be a little stale creatively. But I live in New York, so I go to a library almost every day to write. So that's been my routine in recent years, which has helped me because New York is so hectic and loud that, removing myself in that way has been very beneficial.
If you're writing in a public space, do you do anything to mitigate the background noise, or does that not bother you?
I rarely write in a public space. So the library I go to, there's sort of stacks, and I go to Carol's in the stacks, so it's very quiet, and I'm isolated there. Or I'll write in my apartment. I glancingly, here and there, I've written in like cafes, and I'm luckily someone who, I think this is just how each person's built, but I don't, noise doesn't, I know some people need to have earplugs and stuff, but noise for me has never been a huge source of distraction. I can sort of, maybe it's because I'm from New York and I'm used to just being assaulted by noise all the time. The few times I have written at coffee shops and stuff, the noise hasn't presented a big problem for me.
Oh, when you talked about the staleness of the afternoon, I guess that was, I related it immediately to the noise element and more people just making more noise. But
Well, that's one form. And I think it's also maybe it comes from some weird guilt that creative work isn't sort of like real work, and that by the time the afternoon comes around, it's like you got to deal with errands and deal with, potentially a job, depending on what your work situation is, or, just sort of thing, business that's of the world rather than this fictional pretend, this make-believe. So I think that's part of how I experience it, too.
I'm talking to Jacob Rubin. His book is The Poser. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And one question I like to ask debut authors is how they got their agent. Could you tell us that story?
Yeah, I was coming out of grad school, and I had published, really, I'd done some freelance writing, but I basically published one short story that was in the anthology Best New American Voices, and I sort of asked people. I had a couple of friends who had agents. I had a friend from college whom I'd taken some creative writing workshops with. And I had some teachers, and through those people I had contact. I was able to contact about, I think, four or five agents. And of those, two were interested, and the rest were not in representing me. And I ended up going with the agent that my friend, who I'd gone to school with, had sort of put me in touch with, who when she had worked at the agency, the Wiley agency, previously. So I think it was a combination of, you know, definitely the connections helped a lot, and then also having the sort of publication, and then having a manuscript that happened to jibe with the tastes of those two agents, and Jen, who's my agent, has been my agent for a while. So I think one thing I didn't appreciate was how much it really is about just finding the right fit, both with agents and editors. I think I was under the illusion that it's like, oh, you write something, and if it's good writing, you know, but it's really just about sensibilities and tastes, like everything else.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jacob, we're drawing down on our time, but before we let you go, I want to ask whether there's any favorite writing advice that you could share with our audience.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I think the best writing advice I could give is I'm a big believer in rereading. Reading widely is obviously valuable, but I think I know I personally have gotten a lot out of locating books that I love and just rereading and rereading them and taking them apart and seeing how they work and almost memorizing parts of them. That, I think, has benefited me tremendously.
Mm. Well, Jacob, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Jacob Rubin, author of the new book, The Poser, published by Viking. We're going to take a short break, but please stay with us. Debut author Angela Flournoy will be here for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. The show will join the other interviews up on the web and available via podcast and also available on Stitcher. You can always visit Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads as well as information on past shows and upcoming shows. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. In the first part of the show, I spoke with Jacob Rubin. Next up, I'll be speaking with debut novelist Angela Flournoy. Angela is a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop. She received her undergraduate degree from the University of Southern California. Her fiction has appeared in the Paris Review, and she has written for The New Republic, the Los Angeles Review of Books, and elsewhere. She has taught writing at the University of Iowa and Trinity Washington University. She was raised in Southern California, and her brand new novel, published just last week, is The Turner House, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, which is a summer 2015 Barnes & Noble Discover Great New Writers selection. And I'm so happy to welcome her to the show. Hi there, Angela.
Hi, Nicole. Thank you for having me.
Oh, we're glad you could join us, and happy Pub Week.
Oh, thank you.
It seems you had your book launch party just last night. Is that right?
Yes, I did. I had a reading at SO1 Books in Leimert Park in Los Angeles, and then I had just like a intimate family and friend party afterwards, which very ambitious for Pub Day, but a lot of debut novelists tell me that it can actually be an anticlimactic day. Like, you know, people haven't read your book yet, so you don't necessarily even have a reading scheduled. So I kind of wanted to make sure I had it to look forward to, and it turned out great.
That's cool. And so you're still in L.A. right now?
Yes.
Well, we find that no one introduces a book better than the author. Would you introduce The Turner House to us?
Sure. So The Turner House is a multi-generational family novel. It's set in present-day-ish Detroit. It's set in 2008 Detroit, and it centers around a very large family on the east side of the city. It focuses on their house and sort of the story of their house over 60 years. So even though the majority of the book is set in 2008 during a pivotal spring in a lot of particular family members' lives, we see the journey that their parents took to purchase a house and sort of the changes in the neighborhood over time. So there are flashbacks all the way back to the 40s, but the majority of the book is in present day, and it's really about sort of what it means to be an adult sibling and what it means to be in a city as it goes through very drastic changes within your lifetime.
Now, the book, as you said, is set in Detroit, and you're not from Detroit, so why Detroit?
My father's family is from Detroit, so I've spent time throughout my life in the city of Detroit, and I've become, I think as a writer, one of the things that fascinates me is how setting influences character, just as far as how, where you come from or where you are in a story sort of helps shape your perspective about certain things. And so just growing up and seeing the changes that happened to my father's old neighborhood really fascinated me, because what you have there is a generation of people who saw kind of their setting where all of their, you know, their personal history like erode within 15, 20 years, maybe 30 years. So just going there in the early 90s, and there were more houses on blocks, there were more businesses open, and even 5 years later, seeing that there were more empty lots and fewer businesses open, I was always very interested in what that meant as far as, you know, how do you tell your personal story when these artifacts, these sort of landmarks are that are part of your personal story are just, they're disappearing.
And I want to know or to hear more about how you knew you would start your novel with the scene that you started with.
Well, I actually had my scenes reversed in my earlier draft. So the scene that I start the novel with is sort of the big family legend, which is the story of the oldest Turner sibling, Cha-Cha, having this sort of larger-than-life fight with a haint, a ghost, in the room, which is called the big room, which is what is actually the smallest room in the house reserved for the oldest child. That was not actually always the first scene in the book. The first scene that I conceptualized was a lot quieter. It was just a woman sneaking around a house on the east side of Detroit at night. I didn't know who that woman was, but I knew that she shouldn't, ostensibly she wouldn't have had to sneak around, but she decided that she didn't want people to know she was there. And that person was Layla, who was the youngest Turner child. So Cha-Cha is 64 in the book, and Layla is 40. The first scene that I wrote and I thought would be the beginning of the book was Layla sneaking into the house at night using her cell phone as a flashlight. But structurally and sort of thematically, it made more sense to start with the big family legend and kind of like turn the volume back down after that.
That is interesting. And if I may say, reassuring that, you know, it evolved like that, because I've been thinking a lot about beginnings, and I thought that your beginning was well selected for those reasons that you said. It's you know, the haint is crucial throughout the story, and it's got the drama and it introduces the characters. And we're talking to novelist Angela Flournoy. Her new novel is The Turner House. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And Angela, would you read to us from your book?
Definitely. This is from the chapter Motor City, Friday Night. The chips looked like candy, pastel melt-away things that didn't make sense to save. The feel of them, the click and dry slide of them in her palm was gratifying. Some people in Gamblers Anonymous, a place she hadn't been in months, claimed the tiny ball spinning and spinning around on its wheel was the reason they loved the game. It's like you get a bit of bonus, a little bit of a show from that ball. Zach, a white man who always wore a suit and tie, once said, Other people in the group had nodded knowingly. Layla stood at the foot of the roulette table, just having a look, she told herself. If she were playing, she would never stand there, so far away from the wheel in the top half of the board, a position where she'd end up asking strangers to put her chips where she wanted them to go. If she were playing, she'd request the orange chips, depending on the dealer, but she couldn't play right now. She spent the last of her cash on lunch for herself and her grandson, Bobby, and she didn't know whether she'd be approved for unemployment, so she couldn't spend it, $183 in the bank. No more bets, the dealer said. He waved a pudgy, upturned palm over the table. People settled back into their chairs. The ball landed on double zero. There were a few cheers, but mostly groans. It was a crowded night in Motor City Casino. I think I'll stop there.
Thank you. That was Angela Fornoy, reading from her new novel, The Turner House. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine. Now, what you read to us was from Layla, and a lot of the siblings, the Turner siblings, have vices. And I was interested with regard to Layla. You go pretty deep into this gambling issue she has. What kind of research did you have to do? Did you speak with gamblers, or how did you develop her character?
So I researched sort of the principles of Gamblers Anonymous, and outside of that, what I mostly did was just go to casinos. Luckily, at the time, for the first 3 years of writing this book, I was in Iowa City, and nearby in Riverside, Iowa, there is a casino called the Riverside Casino, which is nothing like Vegas, but it has roulette tables. So, you know, it did the job as far as being able to sit there and just see the way that people interact with each other in that space, and also kind of the rituals that people have. I became very, very fascinated with especially the rituals that people have. And in the novel, I tried to make Layla's rituals and her beliefs about, I read a little bit there, you know, about the color she likes, where she likes to sit. It was clear those things are very important to people as they gamble. And not everybody who has all of these rituals, of course, are necessarily addicted to it. But it's something, like, as a writer that I just found really fascinating.
And as a reader, too, I mean, the time of day, the lighting, it's great details. Let's talk about the structure of the book. So 13 siblings, right? straddling two time periods. And I was thinking back, I saw a panel once and an author was asked why he structured his story to take place all in the course of a day. And he said, well, it was my first book and I didn't think I could handle anything beyond that. And so others have called your book ambitious, and I have to agree with that. It's epic and confident. And so what thoughts did you have about structure when you were beginning the novel? Did you realize how expansive it was going to be?
I knew in my head how expansive the world of the book was. I was not sure how I was going to be able to sort of structure the book in a way that I could have the pieces in the past feel as vital as the pieces in the present. So with the present, part of the book takes place over 5 weeks, and that is because I had a time crunch, which was Layla in that house. I did not believe that she would be able to stay in that house indefinitely. I don't want to give away too much in the book, but I knew that it couldn't be years and years and years. And also, I couldn't not be clear about what day it was, how long it had been, because it was very important. If you don't have any money and you're running out of money, every single day matters. And I thought that that kind of really Layla structured her, like, particular character imperative structured the present day narrative. For the past, I put myself on a budget. I think I read maybe a year into my book, I read an interview with Yoon Lee, another Iowa grad, very talented writer, where she was talking about her first collection of stories about how she had, like, this economy in her mind, that, you know, when you start a book on page one, I mean, you start a story on page one, by page five, this needs to happen, and by page whatever, this needs to happen. And she did that because she didn't necessarily trust herself to just, you know, write it till the end, because it might end up being a novella every time. for me, I had a similar kind of, I think you and Lee said at the end of that interview that now she doesn't do that anymore because it's, you know, putting artificial kind of stress on the narrative. But I actually found that really useful. The sections of the book that take place in 1944 and 45, I did not want them to feel like, I didn't want them to have any drag. I wanted them to feel just as vital as the present day narrative. So I did give myself a budget with those, that every section in the past could only be about, they could never be more than 10 pages. And I stuck to that, and I think that it was hard because there's so many, you know, cool factoids that I read about that were set in that period of time, and I wanted to fit them all in, but I think it was for the betterment of the book that I stuck to that.
Hmm. I want to hear more about the logistics of structuring it and the plotting. So how did you keep track of everything?
I wish that I was more streamlined and organized in that way. I write everything longhand first, or most things, and that is because it feels a little less official for me. I think I take some pressure off of myself, and also it's just practical because if your laptop dies or something, that'll be the reason why you leave the coffee shop and you stop working that day. You can't get an outlet, etc. So writing everything longhand means that I didn't use Scrivener or any other app that kind of helps you keep track of all the ideas that you have. I just have them all in various margins and tops of pages of notebooks. I don't know exactly how I was able to sustain that amount of information, given that I didn't have a Bible, which I think is screenwriting language. I took a couple screenwriting classes at USC, but one thing that showrunners do, say if they're making a new show, for instance, I think the class that I took, it was Gene Roddenberry's like Star Trek Bible, is they make a plot of everything in the world so that you know what can happen, what can't happen. It's so that when people, you know, new people are brought into the writer's room, they can immediately understand how the world works and where they are plot-wise. I should have done something like that, I think, but I did not. I wrote a lot of outlines, and then I didn't follow them. I just knew what I needed to happen in the beginning, and I knew the feeling that I wanted to be at the end, and I sort of wrote every character into their like biggest point of conflict, and then I had to figure out, okay, so now that I've got them all in these sort of terrible places, how do I get them back to where I want them to be at the end? I don't know if that answered your question, Nicole.
No.
But I didn't have a very streamlined approach at all.
But it gives us an honest picture, and it's helpful. We're talking to novelist Angela Flournoy. Her new novel is The Turner House. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine. And I think any writer can relate to that process. Angela, will you talk a little about point of view? You mentioned driving the characters to their greatest point of conflict. And so we spend more time with some characters like Cha-Cha and Layla than others. So how did you find the balance of point of views that worked, given all of the options you had with so many siblings?
I was very fascinated with multi-POV novels and how they are able to communicate to the reader who is most important. They establish a hierarchy. They do it through a lot of different ways, but the way that I was interested in was, I would say, two ways. So one has to do with psychic distance, which is basically how deep inside of a character's sort of like brain do we go, and how much do we get thoughts that are not necessarily related to the plot, not necessarily related to where they're going or where they're coming from. It just helps you understand them. So it might just be, you know, just little asides, things that really make you feel like you're inside of their head versus you're with them in the story, which are two different things. So when I decided, I always knew I wanted the book to be mostly about the first and the last siblings because I thought that it would show sort of the scope of how the dynamics in the family have changed between the time when Cha-Cha was born and the time when Layla was born. So I knew that those characters I wanted to be the closest to. I wanted to make their sort of challenges the most I guess, existential, not the most plot-based. Like, there's the 12th child, Troy, is also present in the book a lot. But Troy, his interests, I tried to make sure. Troy was a greedy character. He wanted to be just as big as Cha-Cha and Layla. I just wrote so much Troy, and then I realized, like, this is not your story, Troy. You need to not be in here as much. And so I had to revise him back out. But it was it's about establishing early on who are you the deepest, like, in their brains, and then who mostly, when you see them, it's helping you. You learn about them, but it also is reinforcing information about the people who are the most important, if that makes any sense. That's how I sort of approached establishing a hierarchy of POVs of who is most important and who is, they're important, but they're not important to the narrative that I had decided that I was writing about.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to novelist Angela Flournoy. Her new novel is The Turner House. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine. And now, you mentioned last night an intimate party with family, and I'm curious what their reaction is to the book. Have they read the book already, and what did they have to say?
A few of my family members have read the book. Everybody has been really supportive. I really come from four large families, so certainly not even, I would say, a fifth of everyone who was there last night has read the book. They have been willing to wait until it was a finished product. So I guess I'll see in the next few weeks how people feel.
Earlier, we spoke with Jacob Rubin, who also attended Iowa Writers' Workshop. And I'm wondering whether you would weigh in on the MFA debate. Do you think an MFA is a necessary step for someone who's serious about writing, or how do you feel about that?
I think that the debate itself, I find it fascinating because it's a debate about, I think, two different things at one time. One of them is, can writing be taught, which may or may not be a worthy debate to have. And the other debate is it worth your time and money to go to a writing program? I think that reading can be taught, being a better reader. I think most people come to writing through a love of reading, but you're not necessarily reading those books as a writer. You're not looking at what sort of devices are at play and what sort of techniques you can pull out to help your own writing get better. So I think that certainly can be taught. I remember vividly when Lance Amatha Chang at the writer's workshop, she had a three-night class on the brothers Karamazov, and she had mapped the novel, basically all of the lines of tension for every single character, where we first see them, where we last see them, how important they are to the overall plot. And for me, when this the Turner House was still just like an idea in the back of my head that I hadn't even gotten any courage to write, that was the first time that I saw how I might be able to do it. So certainly that's something that I wouldn't have learned if I wasn't there. I maybe would have been able to teach myself that, but it maybe would have, I think it saved me some time, certainly, because I saw just what I was explaining to you a second ago about how you can create a hierarchy of characters, even though you have a lot of POVs. But as far as, is it worth everyone's time and money? I think that just depends on the person. For me, I went to Iowa, and I was fortunate enough to have funding, so it was certainly worth the time. And I went to Iowa in 2009. I'd been laid off from my job the year before in 2008. I had no money, so I wouldn't have been able to pay to get an MFA. And I definitely used that time wisely. I started writing the novel when I was there. I stayed an extra year in Iowa City because it's cheap and people take you seriously when you say you're a writer there versus other places. And I stayed a third year to write, and it was worth it. It's not worth it for everyone. People have their own, you know, situations in life. But I think that the MFA, it worked out for me. And I don't think it's necessarily an either-or thing. I think there's also workshops, summer workshops, there's residencies, there's low residency MFA programs, which are sort of more conducive to people with families. I think there's a way that if people want to kind of bounce ideas around with people, that they might benefit from an MFA.
And you mentioned earlier 3 years, and you just said you went to Iowa in 2009. How many years did you work on this novel?
I started working on the novel my second semester in Iowa, so in the spring of 2010, almost exactly 5 years ago from today. And I finished the book last summer, so it was 4 years working on the book.
Wow. And do you write short stories as well?
I have written short stories. I have not published any short stories. Once I started working on the book, I kind of had tunnel vision. So I'm getting back to short stories now.
Mm. We're talking to novelist Angela Flournoy. Her new novel is The Turner House. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine. And Angela, we're drawing down on our time, and you offered some helpful anecdotes when you were talking about the MFA programs, but do you have any additional writing advice that you can offer our listeners?
I would say my biggest bit of advice is to submit to the revision process. Do not try to fight it. Resistance is futile. just when you think it's done, it's not done. Take some time away from it and go back and revise it again. That is probably the biggest thing that I learned working on this book, is just the endurance that it takes to make a piece of writing good. You have to be honest with yourself. Sometimes you say that it's done, but that's just because you're tired of looking at it, not because it's really as great as it can be. So just submit to the process, whether that takes you a long time or not a long time. Yeah.
Amen to that. I wish we had another half hour to talk about revisions alone, but we'll have to settle for that pithy version. Angela, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me, Nicole.
That was Angela Flournoy. Her new book is The Turner House, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, available now. That's all the time we have for today. If you're headed to the Los Angeles Times Festival of Books this weekend, please say hello. Barbara's panel is at 12:30 on Sunday. We'll be back next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m., and in fact, Marie will be on with Orange County debut novelist Aline Ohanisian. Stay tuned for Positive Vibrations with Sister Rue, coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.